From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. On the show today, the new head of the Milwaukee Public Museum talks about the challenges his institution faces.
Younger audiences in particular now are interested in the stories that museums can tell them, the ways the museums can connect them to the past of who they are, where they are, what the world is about, to the present of their experience, and to the future of where they see their own world and their own interests going.
Then we'll talk with the star and directors of the Milwaukee Chamber Theater's new production of Masterclass, which is based on opera singer Maria Callas. And a novel explores a centuries-old conspiracy theory about a Bavarian king.
I don't know exactly what happened, but I think he was murdered. So the truth I give you at the end of the book is completely serious. This could have been the end of King Ludwig.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. This May, a new era began at the Milwaukee Public Museum when Whitefish Bay native Dennis Coyce returned home to become president and CEO of the institution. Coyce started in the field right here, earning his bachelor's degree in museum design at UW-Milwaukee. He went on to NYU, where he got a master's in museum studies. He's held a variety of positions at art museums around the country, but this appointment is his first at a natural and cultural history museum. Coyce first spoke with me in June, and he explained then how his experiences leading contemporary art museums inform this new challenge.
I always wanted to be in the natural history museum world, so I'm excited to be here. But I think the art world itself is a little bit more experimental and willing to take some risks as institutions, particularly the contemporary art side of it, which I was in. And so I think you'll see the public museum think a little more deeply and broadly about what it means to be a museum in this community and how to interface with the community. And there's some real, I think, opportunity in how art museums think about what community means and how to connect people to what they do, which is pretty abstract. And so I think the public museum needs to think about that as well.
Well, give me some examples of what kind of thinking contemporary art museums are doing that maybe natural history museums are not yet.
Well, I can think of two interesting examples. So one might be, how could a natural history museum actually engage with, just to use an obvious example, an artist? There are all kinds of interesting artists out there who are working with our own history, with objects, with sort of scientific specimens, with interests in green issues and global warming. Could you invite some of those artists in to interface with your galleries, with your public, with your collections, and sort of break out of the role that the Natural History Museum is only about dioramas and programs, that you're also about creative interpretation of ideas and transmitting ideas through different cultural mediums? So that might be one example. Another might be, you know, in a more practical sense, the art museum I was last with in Boston, we launched an embedded preschool, which was the first fully embedded preschool at a contemporary art museum in the United States, and got a lot of recognition and interest. But we did it because we wanted to think about how young families connect to institutions over their lives. And so those are kids we're going to track at that museum over 10 years, partnering up with Harvard's Project Zero. So could the public museum be thinking more deeply about how we connect to families, how we connect audiences, and how we graduate people from their childhood connection and their family connection to an adult connection, to how a senior might connect to that museum? I think there's a lot of nuance to how people engage with institutions that the public museum can sort of advance and think about.
Why do you think natural history museums have been slower to the gate in thinking that way? Why do you think art museums have taken the lead on that?
Well, natural history museums have the great advantage of actually being fact-based, right? So art museums take a lot of risks and are interested in that sort of edginess because that's to some degree what contemporary art is about. It's about risk-taking and advancement, sometimes in the absence of facts. You know, the beauty of natural history and natural science and, you know, a museum like MPM is it's based in reality. It's based in factual information. It's based in its collections and scientific data. So there's less room for, sort of fallacies and errors, and we don't want to promote that. But we do want to promote creative use, perhaps, of the collections and the ideas and the facts that stories that collections can tell you. So I think you'll see some of that coming up.
Have the way people used natural history museums in particular changed in the last 20 years, or have they not changed enough?
I think it's both a question of have the audiences changed, which they have, and then have what museums need to do, has that really changed? And I think both those things are true. For our audiences, I think younger audiences in particular now are interested in the stories that museums can tell them, the ways the museums can connect them to the past of who they are, where they are, what the world is about, to the present of their experience and to the future of where they see their own world and their own interests going. So in that sense, I think on a certain level, younger audiences have different expectations of museums. You know, museums like MPM have this incredible history. They came out of a history of collecting the world and bringing it home for everyone to be exposed to, and essentially collecting and cataloging the world for everyone to be exposed to. That mandate is something that, while it still has relevancy and still has generated value for the museum, we have 4.5 million objects, there's great value in that collection. We don't need to go out and collect and catalog the world in the same way. People have access to things that didn't exist when MPM started, like telephones, automobiles, you know, the internet. And so the question of what the museum's role is now and what it needs to be 10, 50, 100 years from now is very different kinds of thinking than the genesis of museums like MPM.
What do you inherit at the public museum, both in the positive side of the ledger and in the negative side? And then how do you take that forward?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, what I think we have as a resource at MPM that we can take forward, first of all, is a great community affinity and support of that institution. I've been going around telling folks already in just my first few weeks running some numbers, that museum is the sixth most utilized natural history museum in the United States per capita. So when you take our attendance and divide it by the population, we exceed a lot of really well-known museums. And how many people come and utilize that institution every single year? And that really tells you something about what it means to this community. So I think that's of great import. I think there's a great sense of continuity and history at MPM. It's a museum that both includes natural history and natural science, but also our local history, cultural history, objects, the story of the city. That's a quite unusual reference point for a museum like MPM. Not all natural history museums collected that kind of material. So I think that's a really interesting piece to think about and take forward. On sort of the challenge side, I would put, you know, and maybe it falls onto both the challenge and the opportunity side, the exhibits. So we have this building full of incredible dioramas. I don't know if all Milwaukeeans appreciate just how special those dioramas are. There's nothing like them in the United States to that quality level and that level of detail. The diorama was invented in Milwaukee at the Milwaukee Public Museum. The first one was built there. It's still on display. And those dioramas are an incredible historic resource. They're almost historic objects in their own right at this point, both in the positive sense that they're really valuable, in the negative sense perhaps that we have not changed them enough and there hasn't been the resources to change them recently or frequently. But the question of how do you navigate that going forward, I think, will be a really interesting one for the museum.
You also inherit maybe a little bit of public, not animosity, but certainly concern about finances. You know, there were all kinds of things that happened before your tenure. Do you think that the museum is in a good position to put that behind it and to tell the public, hey, everything's okay?
It is in a position to put those issues behind it. I think it's in a position to turn a corner and move forward. The museum is now debt-free, or very nearly so. It will be debt-free very shortly. It is in a better financial state than it has been in the last 10 years, and that's thanks in great part to the previous president, Jay Williams, and his predecessor, Dan Finley, for focusing on those core issues. That's not to say that everything is okay, meaning all museums need community support. They need donors, they need funders, they need business support. So the museum, like all museums in this nation, has a real challenge in front of it to raise the resources it needs to transform itself. But we're in a position now, thanks to all that past support, to be ready to transform ourselves and to think about what it means to be a museum again, not just in the sense of staying alive and being sustainable, but in the sense of being visionary and looking ahead to what the city needs and what we could mean to this city. And that's a great place for the museum to be.
So in the short term, what are the first steps that you do to help realize that vision?
Part of it is really thinking about it and communicating out to the community that we're open to partnership and ideas and collaborations. And that's something that we very much are engaged with right now and sort of talking to our communities and what we might do. I think it's about going into a process of thinking big and thinking long term for the museum. And to do that, we need to hear from everyone that is a stakeholder at that museum. So people often talk about strategic plans in the context of museums, which sound very dull and very businessy. But strategic plans, when they're done really well, it's a way to solicit the input from the entire community. everyone of, you know, whether it's geographic diversity, racial diversity, socioeconomic diversity, our employees, our volunteers, our donors, the foundations, the business leaders in this community, we need to get their input on what they need from that museum and what the community sees in it and what its opportunities are. And we need to sort of map that to what we can do uniquely well. You know, we have these resources. We have a collection. We have, you know, exhibits. We have expertise. So how do those two things overlay? What the community needs and what the museum actually has and can provide, and where could we take the museum that will be meaningful for the long-term future of this city and for the museum?
How long do you think that initial process will take you? I mean, you're brand new here, although you are from here, so it's not like you don't know Milwaukee and you don't know the area.
Well,
but
I know Milwaukee of 20 years ago. It's been a while. So I think Milwaukee's come a long way since I was in town, and so I'm learning it afresh, which has been a lot of fun. It will take some time. There's a question of both how do you go through the process of soliciting that input and executing and describing what that plan is, and then how do you communicate that plan out to the community and ensure that everyone agrees that that's where the institution should go? You know, we're truly a public institution. Hence, we need to ensure that our public supports where we want to take that institution. So I envision hopefully we'll undertake strategic planning in the next year and be done with it in the next year and then move on to the phase of communicating that vision and that message out and starting to solicit the support we're going to need and starting to align the institution to do the things that it can do. And that's an exciting opportunity. You know, fundamentally, the museum is going to look very different 10 years from now than it looked 10 years ago. In fact, if we do our job right, it might be almost unrecognizable to what it was 10 years ago. But that difference is what's going to make it exciting, sustainable, meaningful for this community, doing enriching work, leveraging its collections and its knowledge. And that's going to be an exciting change.
Well, while all of that is going on behind the scenes, what's going to be happening for the public face of the museum in the next year? What can the public look forward to seeing?
Well, so we have some exhibits coming up, which are always exciting. There's an exhibit called Aliens and Androids, which is sort of about alien worlds, both off of Earth, but also on Earth, things like deep sea vents and places like that. So we're excited about that. And then next year, there's two major events happening that we're very excited about. The first is the museum's opening its first permanent new exhibit in 20 plus years. It's called Crossroads of Civilization, and essentially is tracking the various components of cultural development across Egypt, across the Mediterranean, sort of how civilization came to be. It'd be a really interesting exhibit that will be here for the long haul, and that's a big achievement for the museum to have gotten to the point where it could reinvest in itself in that way. The other thing that's really exciting, and both for me as a Milwaukeean, a little daunting even perhaps, is the fact that it's the 50th anniversary of the streets of Old Milwaukee in 2015. So I know Milwaukee well enough to know I will be run out of town on a rail if I do anything that wrecks that exhibit. That said, that exhibit needs to be brought up to date and it needs to be recontextualized. It needs to be enriched. And so I think you're going to see us use both maybe a new introduction to that exhibit as well as some really creative technology, very subtle technology, but really creative technology to enrich what that exhibit is and make it new again for people. And I think that could be a lot of fun. So I'm really excited about that.
For all those people who grew up seeing it and have now brought their kids and sometimes grandkids.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's three generations. I mean, 50 years is a long time for a museum to have one exhibit. It goes back to that opportunity and challenge. You know, people connect to that exhibit. And so there's this great sense of nostalgia. And, you know, I have people say to me all the time, you know, I love the streets of Old Milwaukee, but I'm so tired of that exhibit, but don't ever change it. It's sort of this love-hate. And so we need to figure out a way to renew it and refresh it, but also respect what it is and what it's been and what it means to this community. Because it's a great exhibit.
Now, I realize you haven't had time to look at all 4.5 million
objects. I'm easily 0.01% into that process.
Okay. What you've seen so far, do you have a favorite piece that you didn't even know you had?
There are two things that I think are really, really, really interesting. One of them I didn't know we had, and I'm not sure what to do about or think about it yet. So I'm still forming an opinion, and that is an oddity that we own, which is we own a beautiful Bruegel painting, which is on loan to the Milwaukee Art Museum, in fact, and has been for a long time. And that is not something that you would typically see a museum like MPM own. So the question is both, why do we have it? What's the story behind it? What do we do with it? What does it mean? So I think that's an interesting piece and just sort of one of those tidbits that you say within 4.5 million objects of a museum you think of as a science institution, there's a Bruegel painting. Who knew? Along with 45,000 other paintings, prints, and drawings. Had no idea. On the flip side of that equation, there are, you know, our great scientific collections. And I think one of the things that I find really interesting It's a very unique and odd collection, and in the best possible sense of the word, but we have probably the nation's most important collection of historic typewriters, because typewriters were developed in Milwaukee, believe it or not. The first ones were invented here. The first manufacturers were here. And you have this collection that shows not just sort of the mechanics of, you know, what sounds like very dull historic objects, but this was a design problem. It was an engineering problem. How do you make something that humans can use to create words on a piece of paper? It's not a collection that is necessarily easy to tell a super compelling story about. It's something that's completely remote to a 10-year-old now. You know, I mean, they probably haven't even seen a typewriter. So how do you tell that story? I think that's going to be a really interesting collection going forward. And then I'd add one more thing just to make sure that I mix it up with our natural science collections, because we have amazing science and natural history collections as well. You know, we have these incredible fossil collections where we have pieces of rock, including one that's probably 10 by 10 feet that's currently stored in our basement that we're trying to figure out how to get out on display, that shows the footprints of dinosaurs running across a sandbar. And, you know, you can see these footprints, and it just makes it so apparent that these were living, breathing creatures. And, you know, to me, it's just a miracle that it exists here in Milwaukee, and that we have it, and that you can come and see it. And I think that's kind of the magic of a museum like MPM.
Well, Dennis, welcome back to Milwaukee. It is a pleasure to have you back here and also in the studio talking with us today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Whitefish Bay native Dennis Coyce took over as president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum in May. He came back to Milwaukee most recently from a position at a museum in Boston. Our interview with him first aired in June. Coming up next, the Milwaukee Chamber Theater opens its 40th anniversary season with a new production of Masterclass. We'll hear about the enduring fascination for the late opera star Maria Callas when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. That is the singular voice of one of the world's most famous opera stars, the late soprano Maria Callas. Callas was known for her versatility, her musical and acting skills, and her complete dedication to her art. Almost no one worked harder than she, and audiences loved her. She could stop a performance before she sang a note simply by walking on stage. During one performance of Donizetti's Anna Boleyn at La Scala in Milan in 1957, she received a 26-minute-long ovation. It was a record for the venue for a very long time. 37 years after her death, Callas remains a figure of fascination and obsession. Terrence McNally's 1995 play Masterclass uses her real-life classes at Juilliard in the 1970s as a basis to explore Callas's triumphs and failures and to illuminate her passion for her art. Angela Iannone stars as Maria Callas, Jill Anaponicek of the Milwaukee Opera Theater, and James Zager, the head of theater at Carroll University, co-direct. They all join me in the studio, and Iannone began with an excerpt from the play.
You have a lovely voice, you know, a charming sound, much lovelier than mine ever was, and no one ever accused me or my voice of charm. That was my sister. She was the charming one, the pretty one, the one the boys wanted. Anyway, en tout cas, all that got her, wherever she is, I don't know, we don't speak, and got me, where I am, sometimes I think the whole world knows where that is, or was, and which is right now up here talking with you about your voice, your sound, who you are. Who are you? Sophie Di Palma, you've told us your name, but who are you? Tears will get you nowhere, darling. Not in the theater, not in real life, certainly not with me. No one cares how many nights I cried myself to sleep. I sang Norma better than anyone had in years, and I interpolated a high F at the end of the first act. That's all people cared about. When you're fat and ugly, and I'm not saying you're either of those things, you had better have a couple of high Fs you can interpolate into your life. No one cares about your damp pillow. Why should I? Did you care about mine? Did anyone? But that's another story. I can cry all I want to now, but you can't, Sophie Di Palma. You've got to sing for your supper. Sing for your salvation. Shall we try again?
Angela Iannone, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thank you so
much. Thank you.
And James and Jill Anna, welcome as well to you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yes, wonderful to be here.
Masterclass, such a fantastic play. And Angela, this is your second time with it, isn't it?
Oh, no. This is my eighth.
Eighth? But second time here?
Second. Puh. No. This is my eighth production of the show.
But it's the second one for Chamber Theater, yes?
It's actually the third one for Chamber Theater. There was a benefit performance many years ago, a fundraiser benefit while the late Monty Davis was still alive.
Okay. How does it feel to come back to it?
I thought I was done with Maria, and it's really delightful to visit her again with these two amazing directors and a cast of rare excellence. It's been delightful. I will be very happy to be back on the Cabot stage, which I think is the perfect venue for this play.
James and Jill Anna, you are co-directing this. How did that come about?
We sure are.
Yeah. This is our, what do we figure, 10th?
Our 10th collaboration as as a pair, James and I, in different configurations. This is one of the first times we've co-directed a project. Sometimes we split into director, choreographer, producer, director, but we're so accustomed to working together. Mm-hmm. We tend to finish each other's sentences.
I knew you were going. I was there for you. Yeah, I think everybody sort of raises their eyebrows a little bit because it's not normally done. But we're very careful. We always talk with each other. We often have coffee before rehearsals. We talk to the designers, to the actors, and we let them know if there's ever any confusion, just let us know and we will work it out.
And Angela, from a cast member's perspective, how is that?
I like it quite a bit. I mean, most directors have an assistant or an assistant director. The last few projects that I've done at the Rep have included an assistant director or the playwright. So positive collaborations are always a delight to work on.
I do think it's an expression of that hybrid quality of the play. So you have a Broadway play that has music as an integral part, and specifically opera. So this being a collaboration between Milwaukee Chamber Theater, Milwaukee Opera Theater, and Carroll University, together James and I kind of represent the opera theater and student population, too, that's part of this bigger collaboration.
Is this the first time that's happened? Okay. I was thinking, I don't think these three have been together before.
It's so exciting. Mm-hmm. It's so incredibly exciting.
It's really wonderful. The conversations in the rehearsal room when it comes to the particulars of sort of the opera elements of the play are amazing because everyone in there has such an in-depth knowledge that we have even some sort of like little jokes that we use in rehearsal, like I go left, you know, about a tenor. Do we remember who it was? Because I don't.
No, it's Alicia's story.
No
that's
names.
One of the
things.
No names.
But there was a tenor who was in a rehearsal and at a particular point always went left, and the director of this particular opera wanted them to go right because they had staged the other
– The soprano
to the right, and he said, no, I go left. And we actually referred to that. Like if somebody, you know, misses a piece of blocking or something, we'll stop. And often someone will go, no, I know. I go left. Yeah.
Angela, you just came from a wonderful time at Ten Chimneys.
I did.
Congratulations on being one of the fellows for that.
Thank you.
Did that experience help you inform this eighth version of Maria that you are about to bring to stage?
Yes, it did. I think my experience there will inform the rest of my life. Hmm. Such an amazing group of artists being led by the wonderful master teacher, David Hyde Pierce. And the time there, it really was an acknowledgement, a thank you, a time for us to sort of stand and say, you know what? I'm good. I've got this. I know what I'm doing. And to come into this incarnation of Masterclass, not freaking out about any notes that might be given, not worrying about any kind of judgment that might be sitting either in the rehearsal room or out in the audience, so that I have, I think, been able to respond to new direction and new ideas by saying, yes, and let me tell you why I think this will work, and let me take a look at the note that you're giving me without feeling paranoid about it.
That's good. Yeah, and that's such a hard place for all of us to get to.
Oh, yes.
You know, to just kind of take it not as a personal thing, but as part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and part of the dialogue that you have to have in any mm-hmm. creative and collaborative process, but particularly in the theater and in the opera, where it is all collaboration. Everybody depends on everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And it's all judgment, too. I mean, that's one of the things that Callas talks about in the play. And we were joking about opera is one of those few performance venues like Shakespeare mm-hmm. where the audience will show up with a script and follow along and check and make sure that you are doing everything they think you are supposed to be doing. And they always carry a bunch of luggage of I saw this person do it or mm-hmm. I've heard this person sing it. And it takes absolute iron determination and incredible bravery to stand up there at all. People are going to judge you and judge you harshly, and they can't wait for you to make a mistake.
Do you think that's what makes Callas still so compelling as a figure? Now, the fact that she, you know, despite everything that happened, she had some pretty bad reviews in her time, and mm-hmm. she was skewered in so many ways, but she did it. She did it her way as much as she possibly could. Is that part of her appeal still?
Yeah. I was thinking about that this morning and trying to find the words to express my personal relationship with when I first heard Maria Callas sing. And as a really young student, I remember realizing that hers was the first voice I could identify always.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like when I was just starting to listen to opera and any recording, I could always tell when it was her. And I think that that distinctiveness, that uniqueness, that point of view, that specific human quality of the way her biology made her sound and what she did with it, which no one disagrees about that. Her artistry, people are pretty, like, she was an incredible student, an incredible point of view, and such a hard worker. People didn't like her sound. A lot of people didn't like her sound or the way she worked it. But you can always tell it's her. And I think we're in an age now where we tend to iron out quirks in study. And we have an abundance of beautiful singers who really have solid technique and sing safely and can sustain their singing for a long time. But you might not be able to tell soprano A from soprano B.
The word you just used, safe.
Yeah, she didn't play it safe ever.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes her appealing to me, is that she was out there and she took risks.
Well, and she was doing things dramatically. She was doing things that, and Angela and I have talked about this, you know, she wasn't afraid if she was supposed to be lying down or kneeling or running around or doing things that some sopranos might go, well, I can't do this because I need this breath and that. That she was looking at the story, at the play, and delivering it.
It's like a great actor will mm-hmm. do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And she was doing it before it became mm-hmm. de rigueur to do it for opera singers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that in the last 20 or so years, it's expected that you're going to be able to act it as well as sing it. You're not just
going to
stand there.
It's a big sea change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was a long period when operas were sort of recitals with costumes, you know.
Was she the first
really
one
changed
who really
the game.
Changed it?
Not really.
Not the first, but...
Mary Garden. Before her, Rosa Poncel certainly was considered mm-hmm. a terrific stage animal. Enrico Caruso. Yeah, I mean, all great singers have in common that they are always telling the truth. There's a very, very funny story about Madame Zinka Milanov that she was asked on one of the opera quizzes during the intermissions at one of the Mets. They said Madame Milanov was famous for Park and Bark. She'd just stand there and make this glorious sound. And it was glorious, but she didn't bother with anything else. And they said, Madame Milanov, how do you feel about acting in opera? And she said, well, if you can't do anything else. Which was really that sort of point of view
telling.
Of, I'm making great sound. What else do you want from me? I'm singing this beautifully. I'm singing it the way. And it's very exciting sound. I mean, her recordings are very exciting. But if you went to see her in the opera, that you would see her stand there in a beautiful costume and make glorious sound. So Callas wasn't the first.
This play, though, takes place towards the end of – certainly the end of her career. I don't know about the end of her life.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty close to the end of her life,
close.
Which is hard to believe. Because when you do listen to the recordings of the class, the actual recordings of the actual
because
class upon which
happened.
This is inspired.
Oh, yeah.
She has such a beautiful voice. And she is teaching and she's working hard. And you can imagine a future for her. And then, you know, to know that she died just a few years later.
It's even
pretty
more
heartbreaking.
Poignant. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that imparting, that teaching part of it, too, I find so interesting. That's what I find this interesting about this play is that, you know, he chose to write about this as opposed to, say, her early career in the 50s in Milan or whatever. You know, it's this where she's talking to the next generation.
Well, absolutely, that's in there. If the play had been written about anything else, it would be impossible to do. The smart thing that McNally did was not have the actress playing Callas sing, because there is no faking that.
Mm-hmm. We do learn so much more than just – he does use it as a vehicle for storytelling about her whole life, mm-hmm. though the height of her career, the beginning, her relationships with her family, her loves come out in these memory sequences while we're at the play. So there's a great deal of fictionalization through the imagination of Terrence McNally, you know, inspired by this actual event, which were the classes at Juilliard.
And we are in the classroom. I think that isn't it the opening mm-hmm. line something like, you know, don't applaud. Mm-hmm. This is not a theater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that conceit of the classroom, trying to transfer your experience to a younger person, it actually gives us a chance to explore things about Maria. There are great moments where she says, one of the students asked for passion, and Maria says, that's mine. That is why I use it. I need it. I wouldn't give it away. But at the same time, she's looking for the students to have that fire. I think so much in the play as well is about how we as master teachers are trying to communicate things. And you can teach, you can work scales, or you can, as a dancer, you can teach, you know, steps and things. But to be an artist, it comes up over and over in the play. What is it to be an artist? And that's something ineffable. And so some of the frustration that we see is her going, why are you out here if you aren't going to bare your soul? What are you waiting for? Tomorrow, the next week? Give it, give it, give it. And I think that's something that, well, Maria and Angela both share. They give it. I mean, I've stopped referring. I actually come to you early in rehearsal and I hug Angela, because once she becomes Maria, I'm like, well, I would not go hugging Maria.
Don't hug
yeah.
Maria.
So I often go up and go, quick, before,
do it now.
Become, because it is amazing. But I think it's the passion, you know, that's something that they share. And I think that's why it makes you so incredible in this role.
You can't see me, but I'm blushing.
Yeah.
I think one of the brilliant ways about the way that McNally has crafted the text is that the students ask the same questions that the audience is asking. Mm-hmm. How am I supposed to do this? What does this mean? So that the students are the Watson asking the questions. And I think that gives the audience a terrific experience where they might have been sitting there a heartbeat before going, I don't get this. What is going on? And then the student will ask the question that they mm-hmm. were asking in their brain, and it gets answered. But they also get to laugh at the student who didn't know that. So they don't have to confess that they didn't know what was going on, or that was their same question. And I think that's a beautiful way to craft that experience.
It gives the audience permission.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To want to ask the questions, but without having to take the risk.
Yes, exactly.
They don't have to take the risk.
Right.
Yes.
But you do.
Yes.
Yeah, and the students do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the students that you have singing, they do have to sing, don't they?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. they actually have to be singers and mm-hmm. cast as singers as well as actors.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you have as your students?
We're fortunate to have three extraordinary opera singers in this cast. They're all artists that work with Milwaukee Opera Theater. The first one who appears is Sophie, played by Melissa Cardamone, who has been in a number of projects with us, most notably Fortuna the Timebender. And now she's in a very different role. The tenor, who I like to just call Mr. Tony Tight Pants, because that's one of my favorite lines in the play, is Edson Melendez, who sings with the Florentine Opera Chorus as well. And then Alicia Bernesh, who's a favorite performer at the Skylight Music Theater, is singing the role of Sharon, perhaps the most formidable of the mm-hmm. students.
And the interesting thing about the play is that if you're in a master class and you have a master teacher giving corrections, you actually have to cast the singers that can deliver the correction. So they have to have the goods. We don't have to ask the audience to pretend. We have singers who can deliver the goods.
It's almost like you have to be good enough to be bad.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I cannot wait. I am so looking forward to this, because I have to say,
neither can we.
I have read this play, and of course, I've seen, but I have never actually seen it on stage.
So, oh, you must come.
You are in for a treat.
I am so in for a treat. I will go left.
I will go left.
Well, I want to thank all three of you so much for coming in today and break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Angela Iannone stars as Maria Callas in the Milwaukee Chamber Theater's production of Masterclass. Jill Anaponicek, the artistic director of the Milwaukee Opera Theater, and James Zager, the head of theater and arts management at Carroll University, are co-directors of the production. It opens Friday night on the Cabot stage of the Broadway Theater Center, and the show kicks off the Chamber Theater's 40th anniversary season. We'll have a quick break now, and then we'll take a literary trip to 19th century Germany, complete with death and conspiracy theories. It's all coming up on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have your company this morning. Ludwig II, a 19th century king of Bavaria, was known as the Mad Monarch, or the Fairy Tale King. Among other things, he was responsible for building Neuschwanstein Castle in Hohenschwangau, and that building is the one that Walt Disney used as a template for Cinderella's castle. Since Ludwig's life is the stuff of legend, it's also the focus of literature, including a book by author Oliver Perch. The Ludwig Conspiracy is a historical novel that ties together some conspiracy theories about Ludwig's death with real documented history. Perch, who is from Germany, spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon last fall about how the subject matter in his novel differs from the history he'd written about before.
Well, I tell you, if you just write books about executions and torturings in the 17th century, this makes you some kind of mad. That's what my wife told me. So I needed a break. That's right. I needed a break. And I was thinking about what could be a good mystery, a historical mystery. And just by accident, I was reading an article in a newspaper, and it was written about this fairy tale King Ludwig and this king building all this castle. And it was written about his mysterious death, because maybe, as you know, the official theory is that the king was declared insane because of building all these castles. He had a lot of debts, 14 million Reichsmark, which is a lot. And they declared him insane, and they arrested him and brought him to this castle back at the Starnberger Lake. And he went out just for a walk with his psychiatrist, Dr. Gooden. And some hours later, the two bodies were found floating in the water. And it is said that the king tried to commit suicide, and he ran into the water, and this psychiatrist followed him to save him. But the king was very, very big and tall, so he strangled and drowned his own psychiatrist and then committed suicide. So this is the official theory. But there are a lot of conspiracy theories in Germany, what really happened. Maybe you can compare it a little bit to John F. Kennedy here. So King Ludwig is not exactly John F. Kennedy, but there are a lot of conspiracy theories about that. And but to know the truth, I think you have to read my book.
Well, not to give too much away about the book, but in it, he was compared to Michael Jackson.
That's right, because what I heard is that in the States you say the Mad King. That's right. You call him the Mad King, because we call him in Germany, we call him the Fairy Tale King. And I think this is much better, because he was not mad. They tried to declare him insane, but I think he was more a borderliner. He was very sensitive. By the way, what is interesting, he was a great Edgar Allan Poe fan. He loved Edgar Allan Poe. He had a social phobia, that's right. He was homosexual, all these things, but he was not mad at all. And I compared him to Michael Jackson. You know, Michael Jackson, he lived in this Peter Pan park with a castle, or I don't know, yeah, mm-hmm. and slept under an oxygen tent and had this monkey. And I think he died a mysterious death, didn't he?
Yes.
So, So, but he was not mad. He was a pop star. He was a little bit weird, strange. And I think King Ludwig would have been a great, great pop star in the 20th century, but he was born in the 19th.
Well, some might consider him just a free thinker.
Yeah, that's right. And what he was, definitely was a pain in the ass for his ministers. So I don't want to be a minister under King Ludwig, so because he was very choleric and he slept all day. He just lived in the night. He was not in the capital in Munich. He lived in this castle somewhere in the mountains. So it was very hard to make politics with him. So this is a problem. He was not a pop star. The problem was he was a king, and a king has to rule.
Given that there are so many conspiracy theories about his death, how did you – I mean, is your book based on one of those theories, or did you create your own? Or did you go into this thinking that at first you would have to choose between theories, or did that lead you to create your own perhaps?
So let me say, when I started my research, I was thinking, okay, I write now some fictional stuff, but I think the official theory is the right one. But after doing all these researches, now I'm at the point that I say something stinks. This is not the truth. I don't know exactly what happened, but I think he was murdered. So the truth I give you at the end of the book is completely serious. So this could have been the end of King Ludwig. The only thing which is maybe a little bit an invention is I created a villain, a bad guy who is at the end the murderer of him. And I don't know this person, but you need this if you write a fictional novel, you always need a strong villain. So this is my invention. But everything else I think could be the truth.
Including the secret society, the cowled men?
For sure, for sure. We call them the Google Männer because Google is the word for hood, what they have. They are a secret organization. They still exist in Bavaria, and they are quite influential there. So they are, it's said that there are some powerful men among them, maybe politicians. And I try to get in contact with them. It's very hard. But they still try to prove that the king was not a murderer and didn't commit suicide, but that he was murdered up to now. And this is the reason why my book is, on the one hand, is an encoded diary from the 19th century, but on the other hand, is a contemporary thriller, because I found out that there are so many interesting things in our days to write about Ludwig II. I couldn't write just a book in the 19th century, so it's also a thriller.
Can you give us an idea of how King Ludwig of then is viewed now? And did you have to worry at all about presenting him in a way that may be too unfavorable for some people?
I was a little bit afraid then when I did my readings in Bavaria that there were some cult men waiting for me and said, don't go in to this reading, stay outside, and so on. So they didn't show up. But at some readings, there were old people, and they the most problem they have is to say that King Ludwig was homosexual, which he definitely was. And I mean, this is no problem. We've got now a foreign minister in Germany who's homosexual. Our mayor in Berlin is homosexual. No problem at all. And I can't understand why they make such a problem out of this. So that's it. But all the other things, I mean, I write a book about the king is murdered, so I'm on their side. I'm on the side of this cult man, but not with these homosexual things.
Okay. Well, did you have anything to worry about from the modern monarchy?
This is the Wittelsbacher dynasty. So this is still the dynasty from King Ludwig II. They still exist, and they are quite powerful in Bavaria, as I know, because I worked long as a television journalist. And if you work as a journalist in Bavaria, it said, don't blame the Pope and don't blame the Wittelsbacher. These are the two things. Never blame them. So they are quite powerful, and they ignored me. They ignored me. I don't know. I think they read the book. They read the book, but they ignored me because they've got this huge archive, and it is said that in this archive you could find information about what really happened, but they do not allow any person to get into this archive. Not any writers, but also historical researchers. They are not allowed to get into this archive.
Mm. Well, you presented the modern king, interestingly.
Yes, I did. Do you want to talk me about this modern king? And then,
well, you know, he's responsible for some rather nefarious activities.
You know, in the book, you mean?
Yeah, in the book,
okay,
right?
Yeah, but if we talk about this modern king now, I think it could be some spoiler, can't it be? Because for me, it was just say if you write a mystery, you have always to hide your villain, your bad guy, and I was always thinking about how can you hide them so that at the end the writer is saying, the reader is saying, that's it. Ah, I couldn't find out, and I hope it works in this book.
I find it interesting that you brought up the modern repository of books that no one's allowed to read from the family, the monarchy, where that contrasts interestingly with the book, which is one of the characters is an antiquarian bookseller, where you couldn't even get people to read it if you paid them. I mean, so it's interesting that a lot of this is so focused on old literature that. Mm-hmm. Either you can't read or people don't want to read.
That's right, yeah. But if you read my books just by accident, books are always in the center of my novels. I don't know why, because maybe it's just I love books and I love old bookshops. As I was a kid, I always went in these old bookshops just to smell these old books like this old books, this bookseller Stephen Lucas does. And maybe this is the reason also in The Hangman's Daughter series, there's one character, this is Simon, who's a doctor there, and he loves books as well. So, and also in other books I wrote, it's always with old books, yeah.
I was pleased to see that in the story, Milwaukee is just a tiny little part of the story.
Yeah, that's right. that's right. And I think the reason was that I've been here, as you can remember, 2 years before. And this was done the time when I found out that you've got a lot of German immigrants here and so on. And then I was writing and I needed a newspaper. And then I needed an American newspaper, which has a lot of German points of interest in it. And I said, I was remembering, hey, I've been to Milwaukee for this interview. Milwaukee, this is the German town in the U.S. So I chose Milwaukee, and it's fine. I forget it. But this was the reason for that.
Okay. Well, I'm sure everyone here will appreciate that.
Okay. I love Milwaukee. It's true.
All right. How did you approach the fact that it's a modern novel and you have two people who are basically trying to find out what happened 125 years in the past and through books or through mainly one book in particular without, again, giving too much away. So, again, this idea that literature opens the door to the past, is that – would you classify that as a theme or is that just accidental?
In my book, it's an encoded diary, and step by step, they found out that this diary was written by a witness of King Ludwig's death, and they find out what really happened. So – for me, it was interesting when I was doing my research, I found this kind of diary. I was talking to an art professor, very old one, 91 years old, and he told me that he bought a diary from the personal doctor of King Ludwig. It's called Max Schleiß von Löwenfeld. And in this diary, everything is written. So this personal doctor was the witness of King Ludwig's death. Everything is written in it. And he told me he's got the diary now, but he was threatened by strangers. And so dangerous to have this diary so that he decided to hide it somewhere. And I asked him, where did you hide it? And he told me it's in a safe in the United States. That's true. So maybe the secret of King Ludwig is somewhere here in Milwaukee or in some other city in the United States. And I couldn't find out if it was the truth or not. But for me, this was this point where I say, this is the story. I mean, this is great. There is an encoded diary. And he showed me some pictures of this diary. And the diary I use in my book, the cover is the same than this diary the professor told me about. So maybe there is a real one.
All right. Well, going through the book, it's quite the page turner. So if I may just say so.
Thank you.
And also, you're welcome. It reads like, and I hope you don't find this kind of dismissive and insulting, but it could be a movie. I mean, I can easily see that I can picture it in my mind. Is that something that you have in mind, or You also were a television producer. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think because I work for television, when I write, I always write in pictures. I see in front of my eyes, and it's like a movie when I write. So it's the same with the Hangman's Daughter series. And actually, we are now in contact with some people who will do a movie out of the Hangman's Daughter series. So maybe the Ludwig conspiracy will be the next. So we see. And the other thing is that you say a movie. So the main character, this bookseller, not by accident, his name is Stephen Lucas, which is a mixture, I have to say, sorry, for Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
Another secret revealed. Yes. Well, Oliver, thank you very much for coming on. Good luck with your next piece of work. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oliver Perch is the author of the novel The Ludwig Conspiracy. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. He was in Milwaukee last year on a book tour, and Dan Harmon's interview with him first aired then. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.